You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
Jeff and Eric noticed one day that nobody on the internet talked about Blue Bays, so they had to find a way. They'll podcast thoughts on new movies they've discovered through autumn, winter, spring, and summer on Fridays. And when you've run out of films you love to view, tune into jokes, playing games, all this and more you'll find contained on TBS with Bear and Snyder.
Hello and welcome to Movie BS with Bear and Snyder, the internet's only movie podcast. Hey, I'm your host, Eric D. Snyder, and that's my co-host, Jeff Bear.
Hey, I'm your host, Jeff Bear. That was my co-host, Eric D. Snyder. Hey, everybody, how's it going?
Hi. Hi, everyone. Welcome to July.
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. It's July. That means we will be doing our Movie of the Month Club, recapping and discussing Sex Lies and Videotape, and also giving you your July assignment.
I guess it's only an assignment if you haven't, if like us, you haven't seen it before either.
Or maybe you want to rewatch
it. Sure, yeah, maybe you want
to. Because
catch
maybe
up.
You're trying to get 100% on the test. I don't know.
It seems unlikely that we're going to give a test. Knowing us.
First question, true or false? Will we be giving a test?
We have some movies to talk about. The big one. Here we go. Finally, at last, the comic book character of Spider-Man has come to the screen.
We've been waiting a long time for this one.
Yeah.
When would Peter Parker finally get his big break? And the question is 2017, and I think a bunch of years previous to that as well.
You know, in the new one, Spider-Man Homecoming, Peter Parker is 15 years old, which means he was born the year that the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man came out.
So that's why he never references it in the,
right.
In the film?
Right, okay. Yeah, because he was
just too young.
Yeah, too young. He just never saw it.
Yeah.
A lot of the superhero movies, their titles, or they tell you who the villain's going to be or what big event is, like, you know, Apocalypse and the Age of Ultron and Civil War, and this one is Homecoming. It's the Homecoming dance. It's a big thing.
But, like, did you hear how Eric said it the second time? Like, he tried to be menacing, but then he was like, Homecoming.
Yeah.
And that, I think that kind of sums up the movie perfectly. It's like, oh, Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Hey.
Hey.
Hey. You want to see a cute little 15-year-old boy be Spider-Man?
Yeah. And, of course, Homecoming is also a reference to finally Spider-Man coming into the Marvel Cinematic Universe fold. Finally, his homecoming, where he belongs.
Where he belongs.
And it's surprising how many regular people care about that sort of thing.
I don't think regular people do.
I've talked to a couple of regular people who are like, I'm glad finally he's going to be in the Marvel movies. I know.
Ordinary folks?
Well, young people. People much younger than us. Okay. People like half our age.
Mm.
And who knows what goes through their heads, these kids today, with their fidget spinners. Yes, now this is the sixth Spider-Man movie in 15 years, and the third actor to play him. And it's really good!
It is really good. And I think, first and foremost, it is really good because of how they bring the character to high school, in a high school that feels like something that you know. It feels authentic, and most importantly, that lead performance by Tom Holland is great.
So good. He was the kid in the Impossible about 5 years ago, about the tsunami movie, and he's done a couple of things since then. But this is his big thing, and he's terrific. He has such a great personality. The actor and the character have this enthusiasm. This is which is what I like about teenagers. To the extent that I like teenagers, I like that they're enthusiastic. I like they're
cynical. Get your cynicism away from me, teenager.
Exactly.
You're not allowed to have it yet.
I like enthusiasm. I like when they're enthusiastic. And this film really, like you said, it's authentic. The high school feels real. He lives in Queens, New York, and I have spent like almost no time in Queens, but it looks and feels like Queens,
right,
from what I can tell. He's got a favorite bodega on the corner, you know, like someone in Queens would have.
Yeah, and also it really does a nice job of immediately putting you in that Marvel Cinema universe that we were just talking about, because in the beginning, one, you get a tiny hint of, well, we know Michael Keaton's going to be our villain, but why?
Right.
And it's like he's on the construction crew cleaning up the mess the Avengers made.
Yeah.
Like that's where we get a glimpse of his potential annoyance and where his frustrations are going to come.
I like that the organization that's in charge, the newly created department that helps clean up all these superhero messes, is called the Department of Damage Control.
And then we also get a film, I just put air quotes up, by Peter Parker, in which he takes us through his experience that we had already seen in another film. And I just thought that was a great way.
Do you want to mention which film it was?
Was it one of the Spider-Mans? The Amazing Spider-Man? Was it the one with the dubs, Jamie Foxx? I don't know. It's all confusing.
Captain America Civil War is where we saw Spider-Man right. 4. And yeah, we see his own phone footage from behind the scenes of that. And because he's a YouTube kid, you know? He's the generation that films everything. And that's great. It sets up his enthusiasm, and he's like a kid, like you would think, a kid in a candy shop, hanging out with the Avengers. He's 15. He's in high school.
His best friend is Ned, and he's totally entertaining. He is that sidekick that we want, mm-hmm. Especially for a high school movie. He's wide-eyed. He can't wait to learn what his role can be in this crazy new world. Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, he of course wants to tell everyone, you know, to use Peter's powers for popularity. To impress the girls and everything. Let's tell everyone. Right. Tell everyone you're Spider-Man's friend. Blah blah blah.
Because they are true nerds. They're talking about building Lego and stuff, man.
And it's important that Peter be a nerd. He's a science nerd. Of course, he makes the web fluid and stuff. They do that. Play all that pretty well of him being a science with the mind of an engineer. But he also the theme throughout is that he has these superpowers. He has the powers of a god with the brain of a teenager, and so he keeps doing things like. Enthusiastically jumping into a situation without any thought of how he's going to play it out. And my favorite example of that is when he's some bad guys are getting away in a van, so he shoots a web to the back of the van and then gets dragged by the van down the street, bouncing mm-hmm. off garbage cans and stuff. And it's like, oh, you didn't think that through very clearly, did you? Which is very much a teenage way of dealing with things. And over again, he's always getting it over his head, pushing against the boundaries that are put upon him.
And he does have a caring role model in Aunt May, mm-hmm. Played by Marissa Tomei. But she's busy. And speaking of also busy.
And she doesn't know that he's Spider-Man. He keeps that secret from her.
Whereas Happy Hogan and Tony Stark are the distant parents that won't give him the attention he desperately needs during this time, even though he keeps reaching out to them in very amusing ways, and they on rare occasion get a hold of him. That was one of the nice things here is Tony Stark's not in this movie as much as I kind of thought he would be. It's a good bridge. It connects the universe very well, but he doesn't overstay his welcome.
Yeah.
He shows up when it is necessary to move the film in a certain direction or put a little bit more focus on, the building blocks that Peter Parker must go through.
Yeah.
But otherwise, he's at distance here.
And I'm sure this was necessary anyway for reasons of money and contracts, but it makes sense that Tony Stark would foist Peter off on Happy Hogan rather than dealing with him directly.
Yes.
So Happy Hogan is the one we see all the time, and then Tony Stark shows up occasionally when necessary.
Yeah, and there's really grand moments of action here as well, like when he's in Washington, D.C. because of a school trip, conveniently.
Right.
He gets there, but then he runs into trouble. And the Washington Monument, there's a really great action scene that takes place there, mainly for the concept of him attempting to save his wannabe girlfriend, Liz, who I'm happy to report is taller than him. I was so excited to actually have a movie where it's like, yes, there's the woman. She's in high school, and it's accurate
because
she's
taller than boys.
She's a sophomore. But in general, girls can be taller than boys, especially girl actors and boy actors.
Yeah.
So that was just those are the little refreshing things here that are just like constantly pleasant about this film. And the action sequences really do try to capture a good bit of humor, sometimes too much. With the wacky one-liners.
Never. I disagree.
Really? See, here's my thing. Mm. I understand that Spider-Man and Peter Parker are kind of like two different entities in this kid's world. Like when he's Spider-Man, he'll be free. He'll be crazy. When he's Peter Parker, he's reserved. He's nervous.
Right.
I just thought for the movie's sake, I thought a few too many attempted one-liners that I was just like, oh yeah, that's a teenager attempting to say something funny as opposed to appreciating the line that is said.
But to me, that's better than a line that sounds like, oh, sounds like a comedy writer wrote that line for him. Like, I like that.
That's true.
I like
that's
the film. The film is very, very funny. It's easily the funniest superhero movie ever in the history of mankind. But it's not jokey setup punchline, yeah. Snarky, overwritten. The humor all feels very natural. And there's lots of subtle humor and little details like the bored tour guide at the Washington Monument is funny.
Yes.
That's a funny thing that didn't have to be funny. There's a detail where Spider-Man is fighting bank robbers who are dressed as the Avengers, and in the background is a poster warning against identity theft.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie doesn't draw attention to it. Doesn't say here's a joke. Just it's there. Lots of little details like that.
Donald Glover is pretty fantastic when he's in this film. He's not in it much, but man, does he nail it in the sense of like he's an aloof, small time criminal kind of guy,
right?
That just like gives out some really good, important advice for Peter Parker to hear, or I should say for Spider-Man to hear.
The villain, his name's Adrian Toomes. They call him Vulture. It's Michael Keaton, and he's using alien technology to make high tech weapons and sell them illegally. He seemed kind of vaguely motivated to me.
It was weird for him to keep depending on saying he was doing it for his family when he so clearly was doing it for greed.
Well, yeah,
and for kind of sort of revenge or like putting he wants a seat at the table, that kind of feeling.
Yeah.
So that was just a little weak. I totally agree with that.
But as a villain, he's very good. He's very menacing, and he's got those Michael Keaton eyebrows, and yeah, he works in the moment.
And there is something about the everyman being frustrated by what the heroes have brought to this world.
Yeah.
Like, so that was almost good enough. And again, you're right. Totally like Michael Keaton doing this role is a benefit to us. There's also the way that this movie uses Captain America is brilliant.
Wonderful.
And of course, with all Marvel movies, I think we have two post-credit scenes here, so stick around.
Stay through the credits for sure.
Yep, but that, like, Captain America's involvement and the way that it's just, I mean...
It's very funny.
And we didn't even actually talk about this. Is it Karen? Am I getting Karen's name right? The computer?
Oh, yeah, the computer voice in Spider-Man's suit, is that who you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I really liked – so we don't get a sense of
Peter Parker's backstory. His suit. Tony Stark has made him a suit. Well, I like how they show a scene all in one shot of him actually changing into the costume, which that's usually those movies skip over that part. Like the actual logistics of how do you put on the costume and where do you do it and hide your clothes and all that. But the suit is that Tony Stark made it for him, and it's got some training wheels on it. So he can't unlock all of the thing it can do until he does. And then, yeah, it turns out he's got a computer voice.
Yeah, I feel like – so growing up, I really cared about Spider-Man. And so there's a couple things missing here. Spidey senses seem to be non-existent.
Oh, yeah, they don't mention that. Yeah.
And Uncle Ben. You can try to find it all you want. You're not going to actually find it. You can assume there was an Uncle Ben, but it's not a known thing necessarily.
I think isn't there like one line about how Aunt May has been through a lot or something?
Yes.
Yep. And that's it. Yeah.
And so we can assume, but it's not necessarily. And then it's replaced with this really cool thing where Spider-Man doesn't know what his suit is capable of. It's not just him that he doesn't know his abilities, but he's trying to figure out how to use this thing to the best of his abilities as well.
Right.
And that creates a lot of fun here. There is something about there's so many Spider-Mans that it's hard to just feel like this is utterly unique when you see Spider-Man using his webs to pull things together.
Right.
And he's got to strain to do it. Like, all I could think is, yep, Spider-Man 2. Subway scene.
Yeah,
I love
yeah,
that
we've,
scene.
We have like, seen all these things before, or many
so
of the things.
Yes, and so there is a little bit of that going along the way, and that's unfortunate.
Another slight issue is that Aunt May, there was all this hoopla over Aunt May being younger and hotter than Aunt May usually is, but then she doesn't do anything in the movie. She doesn't serve any purpose in the story, unfortunately.
Totally wasted.
And you know, Marissa Tomei is fine, but yeah.
She could have gone out of town on vacation.
She is very much the definition of a character who is included just because the character is supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume she'll have more to do in future movies. It's too bad because besides the regular people I've heard who are excited about this, I think more regular people are like, we've already seen Spider-Man. And it's a shame because this is better than most of the other Spider-Mans.
Yes.
I don't know if I like it more than Spider-Man 2, which I love so much.
I love Spider-Man 2 so much that I don't think so either.
But this is better than most of them, and it's a shame that probably a lot of people will not bother with it because they feel like they've seen it before. And you know,
I feel like you're trying to get people to not watch this movie just because it's one of ours in the summer box office contest, and I don't appreciate that one bit.
No,
everybody should see this new unique twist.
Everyone should see it
on Spider-Man.
Everyone should see it. I'm saying that it's a shame that some people probably won't. They should. Who directed it? John Watts, who made a film called Cop Car that played at Sundance mm-hmm. a couple years ago. And on the strength of that, he got this.
And the good thing about Cop Car, my favorite thing about Cop Car was the kids. And mm-hmm. he does bring out the kid universe very well.
Somehow the movie has six writers. Three pairs of writers who worked on the film. But still, even for a movie to have three writers and turn out this good is surprising.
Yeah. You and I definitely had we both looked at each other kind of like, what? But we liked it.
I wouldn't be surprised if one of those pairs of writers was just to punch up the humor and like didn't change the story at all. I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised. It's terrific stuff. Very fun. And only a couple of, minor flaws. And I give it a B+.
Yeah, it's an 8 out of 10 for me. Spider-Man Homecoming. BS approved.
Nice. Let's talk about The Big Sick.
Yes, let's do that.
Starring Kumail Nanjiani, that funny Pakistani comedian fellow.
Yeah, this is his story. This is his story along with his now wife.
Emily Gordon, who co-wrote it with him. It's clearly autobiographical. He plays a character named Kumail Nanjiani. Or
also a stand-up.
And comedian,
moved to Pakistan or from Pakistan at the age of I think 14 or 15,
something like that. And he's in Chicago now, in the film, being a stand-up comedian. And here's his situation: he's got his very traditional Pakistani parents trying to set him up. They do arranged marriages, or as
they
call
it,
brother did. They just called it marriage.
Yeah, I like that.
And so every time he goes home for dinner. His mom has a potential candidate drop by for an appointment, and that's how it works. But he is not, and they're devout Muslims. He is not devout, sort of hiding the fact from his parents that he's not faithful anymore, doesn't pray anymore.
Yeah, he is not comfortable with his family knowing who he really is.
Yeah, and then he meets a girl named Emily, played by Zoe Kazan.
Zoe Kazan is one of the wonderful like indie actresses who you've seen in a handful of things. That's kind of how I would describe her. How do you know her best?
From being in a bunch of those movies.
Yeah.
she was Ruby Sparks in that movie, Sparks.
I think she also, didn't she write that?
She did write it, yes. Good call.
Thanks.
She's adorable. I love Zoe Kazan. I love her scrunched up little smile. And she's adorable. I like looking at her.
She's adorable. They have a wonderful chemistry right away. The way that they play off of each other and kind of pick on each other is just adorable in the beginning, whether it's her talking about I don't date time nerds or like there's just such a lovely array of toss away lines that give you insight to who these characters are. And make you feel connected to them.
And he's a comedian, but she is not a comedian. She's a grad student working to become a therapist. But she's a funny person. And yeah, mm-hmm. the way they play off each other as funny people do, it feels authentic. And it should feel authentic because, based on Kumail and Emily's real story. And so at first the tension there is what about his family? Is he going to tell his family he's dating an American girl? And then when he hasn't told them how that's going to be an issue, that part is sort of standard rom-com where there's somebody lying about something and the other one's going to find out and it's going to be a problem. But that happens like 35 minutes into the movie.
I was just going to say, that's the nice part. They condense it very nicely to where you're still interested in that part, even though you have a hunch that, some conflict like that is brewing.
Right.
They do it in a succinct way. And when it occurs, you're kind of nodding along. You're understanding that these people and the decisions they're making, it doesn't feel like rom-com out of place, but forced into this formula that you're used to.
Right.
Feels natural.
And then the actual story then is that right after they sort of split up because of this conflict, Emily gets very sick. Hence the title, The Big Sick.
Yeah.
And Kumail now is involved in that. He has to make, there's no family nearby, so he has to make some medical decisions. And then her parents show up. Her parents are great.
Oh my goodness.
Holly Hunter and Ray Romano.
Holly Hunter is so fantastic. And you're going to appreciate Ray Romano in a new way if you've decided not to appreciate Ray Romano mm-hmm. for a really long time.
They're both really good in this, and she, you know, the mom, Holly Hunter. I don't want her mad at me. I don't want Holly Hunter mad at me ever.
Exactly right.
But if she ever does get mad at me, then I hope that when things are resolved, that she smiles at me the way she smiles at Kumail the last time she sees him in this movie.
And, yeah, and
that sort of
there's...
it's all right.
She knows everything. Like, her daughter, Emily, shares everything with her. Mm-hmm. So she knows the situation. She knows he's an ex-boyfriend. And easily and rightfully so calls him out on it. Because there's definitely some awkward moments where you realize, not only is he, you know, flawed in the sense that he doesn't want to tell the truth, he doesn't necessarily know how to be a good person in this odd situation.
Yeah, it's very awkward to him. And I like the really authentic seeming moments, like where the parents have come to the hospital and met Kumail there, and then they're going back to Emily's apartment, and the details of going to her apartment with her parents when she's not there, and them seeing her things, and that all just feels very authentic, realistic moments.
Yes, I won't say what they are because I want people to enjoy that moment, but there was like three little things that I wrote down right from that just makes you, again, feel like everybody is paying attention and doing a good job crafting this film.
And so the medical, it's kind of a few kinds of movies. It's the romantic comedy, and it's the religious parents and struggling with that, and then the medical crisis, all ultimately in the service of what is basically a love story.
Basically, eventually. Yes.
I, another nice little touch is that when they're together, Kumail and Emily, is the way that she pronounces Pakistan, the way he does. She doesn't say Pakistan. She says Pakistan, like he does.
Mm-hmm.
Which is such a nice little touch that I buy as something that someone does when they're in a relationship with somebody, you know.
When they're learning about right. something more than themselves.
That's how you say it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, with Ray Romano, there's a great thing about Holly Hunter, calling out her, you know, in the movie, the character is like calling him out for not being funny. There's a great attempted joke that is just amusing. It's really a great light that he's put in.
Yeah, he's a good dad, and you know, and when his wife tells him, when she makes a crack about him not being funny, she says he's about as funny as a fart at a funeral. A fart at a funeral is hilarious.
Depends on the funeral.
No, inherently, fart in a funeral is inherently funny,
especially if it comes from the casket.
Oh yes, especially then
like, but that's something to talk about for the rest of days.
A fart from anybody at a funeral is very funny. So I Holly Hunter, I think you're mistaken there.
So this is directed by Michael Showalter, from Wet Hot American Summer and the State and everything else like that. His previous movie was Hello, My Name is Doris.
Yep.
He is like quickly becoming a wonderful director in the world of here's a drama with like comedy. It's a drama. It's a comedy drama. What do we like? You feel like this is a comedy first, right?
This one, I mean, it does kind of. This one kind of does kind of split, but it's a comedy overall.
It really does split. Yeah. Comedy overall. And he's just killing it. Like I can't wait for him to do more. That's really exciting to see.
Yeah.
With all of that, and the wonderful script and everything, I think I have a favorite line from this movie.
What is it?
And it is this. It is when Emily says, I love it when men test my taste. Because there is a standard thing going on in the beginning when they're dating where it's kind of like...
He wants to show her movies to see if she likes them. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like...
Testing her taste.
Yeah, I've been there.
That was very funny.
And that line just like correctly makes you realize what's going on and why you're doing it. And I just think it's such a brilliant little tiny thing.
That was very funny. Amy Bryant and Bo Burnham play fellow comedians. I like them. They're helpful. I think the movie is feels long.
Are you okay? We're ready for this part.
Yeah.
I think the movie feels long too.
And it's not, it's a, it comes in just under 2 hours, but it, it feels about 20 minutes too long.
You know what's really weird? For me, I think one of my biggest problems is Kumail is a good actor. He is miscast in this movie. he's too old.
He's playing the type.
He's playing himself from what? 15 years ago, probably? But, like, it's not, like, the movie's updated. There's Uber.
Right. It's set in 2017.
What's that?
It's set in 2017.
Yeah. But, like, he's 39 in real life. When there's young comedians, and actually nobody's young in this, they all decided to age up, it feels slightly out of place for them to, like, take leaps of creativity and stuff like
that.
Yeah,
I thought that a little bit too when we first see him in his apartment. He's got a roommate, a useless roommate, sleeping on the couch, and they sort of make jokes about that he lives in this, you know, squalid bachelor apartment. But yeah, for a 38, 39 year old, that's too old to live in an apartment like that. That's something that, like, someone in his late 20s does, live like when this all happened 10 years ago or whatever. Yes. But yeah, I agree with you there.
And if you take note of that, something that you could potentially do is, like, just insert that a little bit more into the script.
Like, why are you still living like
this?
Mom,
yeah, would be flipping out. She would never want her third. Like, there would be references of, like, do you not like women? What the heck is wrong with you? What is going on? In a constant state of panic, as opposed to the adorable way that it's done in this movie.
Yeah, but it's still very good. It's still a really good movie. The Big Sick.
It really is.
And I give The Big Sick a B+.
Yes. I give The Big Sick an 8 out of 9.
That's not how that works. And then we come to a little comedy called The Little Hours, which premiered at Sundance. I saw it there. I remember seeing it at a midnight screening.
Oh, is that how you ended up seeing it? I remember having to make a tough choice with, like, a normal timed screening.
Yeah.
And choosing the other thing.
Saw it up there at the Egyptian Theater, as I recall. And then you watch it on a screener. So we've both seen it.
And now, because of that, what we like to do on the show is review it.
The Little Hours is based, of course, on the Decameron. Were you familiar with the Decameron?
Oh, gosh. It's on my nightstand. Never.
No, yeah, no, me either. I missed this part in my old world literature classes or whatever. Apparently, this was an influence on the Canterbury Tales, which came a bit later. But the Decameron, a bunch of stories from, little tales of love and whatnot from the 1300s, I guess.
Yeah.
And so this movie is loosely based on those tales, which makes sense when you see the movie, because as I recall, the movie is sort of wanders around in search of a story. Sort of lots of little vignettes happening, but not like a very strict plot per se.
Do you want to know why? I found out why from a Dave Franco article.
Because it's based on a bunch of loosely connected stories?
No, because there's a 16-page outline. There's no shooting script.
That's all?
And it's like, oh,
that
okay.
Makes sense. Because
you should have told me that before.
Everyone's playing the type. It's about nuns in a convent back in the 1300s or whatever. And
hang on. Stop right there. Because I write down, cursing? What am I watching?
Yeah, like, it's cursing nuns. But it's Aubrey Plaza, Alison Brie, Kate Micucci.
And the idea of it is in these times, they're like, you know how in certain times in our history, like, women were just like, all right, I'll be a receptionist.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I'll do. Apparently, back in the day, it was just like, well, I don't necessarily have a calling. I'm just going to be a nun for a while.
Right.
Even though I'm still curious about sex and don't have any problem, throwing spears at guys and stuff like that.
You just go be a nun for a while. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the story concerns these nuns, their convent. Dave Franco plays a servant who flees from his master, who is Nick Offerman, who I love. Nick Offerman is very funny as Lord Bruno. And then
he's really good.
Who's his wife? His wife, what I love, because he is mean, and he's genuinely fearsome, but I love that his wife's attitude is just to mock him. And to just roll her eyes at him. She's a great foil for him.
Is that Lauren Weedman?
Yeah. Yeah, that's Laura Weedman.
Yeah.
Lauren Weedman.
Also, another guy who just cracks me up throughout the movie, he's not in it very much, Adam Pauly, he's the guard Yeah. And it's just like the indifference from like scene to scene. And then he's like, ah, we're all just trying to get by. Sorry, got to bring you in, buddy.
And so there's lots of just, little farcical just, shenanigans with the servant yes. who's hiding at the convent pretends to be deaf mute. For some reason, I mean, that one I know is from the Decameron. There's not really a good reason for it in the movie, but
yes, it is.
Not really,
because the other servant talked, and so then John C. Reilly decides, oh, it must be the problem that he talked, and that's why the nuns hated him.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Like this guy can't talk.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
so he won't be a problem.
So it's a lot of. I mean, that's the basic joke is that it's 1300s, but people are talking and swearing and acting. Anachronistically, and it's quite funny. It's quite funny and buffoonish and silly.
Yep. And I mean, the main thing is a lot of these nuns have an eye for Dave Franco.
Sure.
And you know, hijinks.
Hilarity ensues. I it's been a few months since I saw it, but I, as I recall, my thoughts would have been like in the B range.
Yeah, you are correct because I know how I feel about it, and I also know exactly how you would feel about it if you had watched it with me.
It's a solid.
Yeah, Little
Lapper.
Hours is a 7 out of 10.
So there was a new Will Ferrell movie last weekend.
Nah, nobody heard of that. It's impossible. If he had a big summer movie, we all would be talking about
you'd
it.
You'd think, yeah, The House, Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler, and Warner Brothers just sort of dumped it, didn't screen it for critics. I didn't really see a ton of marketing, but I don't always.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
And I had seen the trailer, and it made me laugh. And of course, it's Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler, who I love.
And I mean, yeah, the tagline to me that sounds like something that would be great. A dad convinces his friends to start an illegal casino in his basement after he and his wife spend their daughter's college fund.
Is that what IMDb says?
That's what IMDb says. Is it way off?
That is way off. Yeah.
Cool.
So here's what actually happens. they just don't have any money. It's not like they wasted it. They just don't have any. And she was supposed to get a scholarship from the town, but Nick Kroll, who plays the town, one of the city councilmen, turns out has embezzled that money. So the scholarship's gone. So their friend, Jason Mantzoukas.
One of the funniest people around.
He is a gambling addict and newly divorced, and he... They go on a trip to Vegas and see how quickly they can lose money. And so then Frank suggests, why don't we open an illegal casino in my basement? Because the house always wins. That's the thing. They're at Vegas and he says, well, the house always wins. And then one of them says, what if we were the house? And so, yeah, so Frank convinces Scott and Kate, are their names, to do this casino thing in his house.
Oh, it's in Frank's house. It's
yeah,
not
in
even
Frank's
in their
house. Yeah,
oh,
okay. Yeah. Well, because they got to hide from their daughter. Oh, sneak okay, around. Sure. And that's all. That's a fine premise. That is a fine premise for a movie, and they get to it pretty quickly. But then the question is, where do you go with it? And whatever the answer is, it's better than what they came up with here. Which is,
go ahead.
For one thing, Frank keeps the money they make. He keeps then spending it on upgrades to his underground casino, which is frustrating because hey, you've got the money. Stop now. But then beyond that, they run into problems with actual gangsters who actually run illegal things.
That would be
don't do much with that either. The problem ends up being that there's no remorse or redemption for the very wrong actions done in the movie, and so it sort of ends up feeling kind of pointless. And more importantly, it's just not very funny. It's got it has its moments, and Ferrell and Poehler are doing their best. And
who's the first round pick out of this? Who's the funniest? Who comes away
Will
looking
Ferrell.
The best?
Will Ferrell, because I'm biased. it has its moments, but they needed to come up with a better story for what to do after they open the casino. But it's not terrible. But it's since I love Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler, that's why I like it.
Like this movie?
All right, why I tolerate it? It's a C+.
All right,
but it's like you know, say you like mint chocolate chip ice cream, and someone gives you mint chocolate chip ice cream, even if it's the lousy store brand, it still tastes like mint chocolate chip ice cream. Even if it's not very high quality, so it's still okay.
You still kind of you say thanks.
Yeah,
and
so
just move along.
If you like this flavor, Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler, then you'll probably find it acceptable. But yeah, there's no reason to hurry out and see it. So, the summer box office challenge. You may recall last week we were saying, well, Jeff's in good shape because Despicable Me 3 probably going to do like $100 million.
Well, jinxed it.
Yeah. $72.4 million.
Oh, boy.
So it's disappointing for you.
It is a little disappointing for me.
Not for me, though. I feel very happy about that.
You know what I did after that number came out? I went online to look at the dance classes I could choose from. I was just like, well, what am I going to get myself into here?
Have they announced what they are yet for the fall term?
Not officially. Okay. No, I was just looking at their summer schedule.
Right,
just
yeah.
Just get a flavor. I think I'm still leaning towards tap, but we'll see.
That would be great. We should, you know, we haven't reiterated the stakes of the bet, I think, since we started. So in case people have forgotten what's at stake here. Yes, the loser will have to take a public education dance class at Portland Community College. The loser will have to record a solo audio commentary for a movie of the winner's choosing. I'll choose something you hate. I'll choose something long that you hate. Also, the loser will dress in a full clown costume for 3 days of Fantastic Fest. And if I lose, I have to babysit your kids for a day while you sit at my house and watch movies or something.
Uh-huh.
If you lose, you have to pay for me to get a 90-minute massage, which you have to watch.
That's the weirdest part. I know. This is weird. I'm calling you out on that being weird now.
But it makes sense because there had to be an equivalent. If I had to babysit your kids, it's not just that you're getting free babysitting. There's also a mental anguish on me. I have to take care of these children.
That's true.
For you, there has to be some equivalent mental distress. So, yeah, it's all very fair.
I wonder if I would have won, which it doesn't look like I would, Paul Blart Mall Cop 2. Ugh. That would have been funny if I would have made you do the audio commentary of that after you had to watch it so many times and do the running diaries of it.
That would be terrible. And it still could happen because I have three movies left. You've got six movies left.
Yeah. Here's the nerve-wracking part for me. I think I had figured out that my movies, for me to have a chance, I needed to average $60 million. And I know that a lot of my movies aren't going to open at $60 million, so I needed Despicable Me to really buffer that.
Right.
And it barely buffered. I'm in a barely buffer situation, and I just don't care for it.
Yeah, you have Spider-Man Homecoming, which is tracking at about $100 million.
I heard $125.
When did you hear that?
I don't know.
Did you make that up?
Yeah.
And, no, I checked right before we did this. And then War for the Planet of the Apes is tracking
60.
At 60, which is which is good, but it probably won't be enough.
It comes down to Transformers versus Wonder Woman. That's how I like looking at it. Messed up. I think that, like, if we switch those movies, it's like whoever had those two, like, that'll be the big difference.
That may have been,
if that was one underperformed and we're happy about it, and one overperformed and we're happy about it.
Yeah,
but
that's
like
true.
Into it, we would have assumed it would have been the other way around.
You had a chance to choose Transformers or to choose Wonder Woman and did not.
Oh, I had a couple of chances.
You chose.
I even took the Mummy before it and War.
You took the Mummy. No, those.
Oh, I didn't.
The Mummy was after, but yeah.
Oh, I took War and Transformers. Uh-huh.
But Dunkirk is the wild card that could be a very big hit and could help you.
Like $200 million?
Probably not that.
Oh,
I mean, it's physically possible, but like there are that many people in America who could see it.
What is the policy on me buying 10,000 tickets but then returning them, like on Monday? What does the rules say about that?
I'm pretty sure you can't return tickets a few days after the movie played.
Oh.
I think it has to be an in-the-moment refund kind of situation.
All right. I'll think of a new plan then.
Also, I don't think you can afford to buy 10,000 tickets. That's a lot of money.
You don't know me.
I mean, you can try it. There's no harm in trying.
I appreciate that. So as the totals stand right now, Eric has?
$437.5 million.
And we think he'll get at least $500 million. And I currently have
$172.6 million.
That is not close to $500 million.
You're going to, if Spider-Man's 100, there'll be 272, and then 233. You'll probably end up at about in the early, you'll probably end up about where I am now, 437.
Yeah, which, I mean, again, that's Switch, Transformers, and Wonder Woman.
So if my three remaining movies just don't come out, they just cancel them.
I want to move on. I want to talk about something else.
All right. So we started a new thing where we do a movie of the month, where we choose a movie that we both have not seen before, but that we really should have by now, and shame on us. And we watch it, and then we talk about it. And we did the part where we watched it, and now we're going to do the part where we talk about it. The movie was Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Directed by Steven Soderbergh.
This was the big one. It was his first movie. Put him on the map.
Won the Palme d'Or at the old Cannes Film Festival in 89.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and had been it was a breakout at Sundance, too.
You know, it wasn't even supposed to be in the competition for
Cannes.
Cannes? Yeah, it was just going to be like in the director's thing, and then like kind of last minute.
Yeah, I think because it had done so well at Sundance, you're like, oh, this movie matters. And that was also kind of what started to put Sundance on the map as a place where great independent films could emerge. So it has some history behind it, and I'm glad to have finally watched it because I think there's still a few other Soderbergh movies that I haven't seen, but this was kind of the main one that bothered me.
And yeah, it bothered me too that you hadn't seen it, so that's good. I mean, I didn't care that I hadn't seen it, but yeah, it really got to me.
It's the kind of Steven Soderbergh movie that I don't like as much as the other kind of Steven Soderbergh movie. Because you know how he'll do some of these artier ones. Like, do you remember The Girlfriend Experience?
Yeah.
Or Full Frontal?
Yeah.
And they're kind of talky and sort of not very experimental, but somewhat unconventional. And I like Sex, Lies, and Videotape more than I like some of those, but not as much as like The Limey or Ocean's 11 and Traffic. You know, these bigger sort of more movies that are more meant for me.
Yeah, this is one of those films that it feels important to see no matter how you're going to end up feeling about it. Like, it's good to have an opinion about this film.
Yeah.
It's kind of how it took away from me. I mean, because for me, one of the problems is, although it's not a problem here, Andie MacDowell, here's what I finally figured out about her.
Huh.
At her best, her wheelhouse is she is trying to describe something or look confused about something.
Yeah.
Like, that is what she is really good at, but I don't know if she knows that as far as her overall spectrum of performance. So for me, it's always that, like, oh boy. Like, you know, Groundhog Day, to me, it's like one of those, let's replace her with somebody, and I think I'm on board even more with that film. But, like, what's really cool here is the beginning, you are left wondering what's going on because you hear her voice. You don't know what is going on. You don't know how these characters intertwine with each other yet.
Right.
And that's a really cool thing. And then when Peter Gallagher shows up, I can't remember. And if he's done a performance like this, I don't think I've seen it.
Like he's this such, in what way?
He's such a big a-hole.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he is amazing at it. And I've never seen that side of him. Just like on the other hand.
Usually he's a nice guy.
James Spader, who is normally smartest guy in the room, king manipulator, and smug as all get out, is this sheepish little nervous, trying to explore something but doesn't know what, yet still is a manipulator. And I've never seen that side of him before either. So it was really cool to feel like you know these actors and their history, but then watch them do something different in this movie.
See, but I think James Spader in this, I think he is really smart in this. He has issues. He's impotent. But I think that he's very crafty. I think the character acts like he's not as smart as he is. The setup, if you don't know the situation, is Andie MacDowell is married to Peter Gallagher, who is cheating on her, and she's sort of uninterested in sex. And then James Spader plays an old college friend of Peter Gallagher's who shows up. One of those guys who you're not sure where he's been the last several years, like what he's been doing. And he shows up, and it turns out that his thing is to film women talking about their sexual experiences and fantasies. not having sex or anything, just talking about it.
Right.
And he keeps these videotapes for his own salacious purposes.
This is the funny thing. It's perfectly dated because he's got tons of these tapes.
Right.
And the main thing the women are concerned with is, like, are you going to show them to anybody else?
Right.
He says no, and they're like, okay, cool, let's do this. That doesn't exist in our world anymore.
No.
Nobody assumes that something is for one individual. We assume if it's been created, it will eventually be seen by all.
Be on the internet, yeah. Also, the fact that they're on videotape, if this were now, people wouldn't know he was doing it because he wouldn't have videotapes sitting out on his shelf at his house with women's mm-hmm. name on them. There would just be files on his computer.
And that's really that you're right that he figured out if he displays this sort of thing, this is the key way to seduce a woman right. to participate in
right.
it.
Right. Did you notice that Peter Gallagher's character name is John Mulaney? Like the comedian? It's spelled
no.
different. It's spelled different, yeah. but yeah, John
no,
Mulaney.
That did not.
Did you notice that James Spader's apartment looks like mine?
That, no.
The layout, not the layout, but the style of it, the floors and the molding around the door frames and the all of that, sitting here in my apartment watching it, it was like, wow, this reminds me of my house. I don't have videotapes of women talking about sex, though. Just
no,
FYI.
You don't. I've looked everywhere. Did you notice the like how he was surprised he couldn't smoke in the house?
Yes.
That's another I love any time smoking like occurs in movies from a while ago.
Yeah.
Like in any way that it comes up.
What else about this movie? Oh, there's a quote here in a couple years later, Steven Soderbergh said, when I look at it now, this movie looks like something made by someone who wants to think deep but really isn't. To me, the fact that it got the response it did was only indicative of the fact that there was so little else for people to latch onto out there. So that's Soderbergh being reflective about his own movie, and probably some truth to that.
Well, and one of the things that it does very conveniently is the risque aspect of this film is really about how reserved Andy McDowell Anne's character is. Like, if she's not so over-the-top reserved, it doesn't feel like there's layers being pulled away that are, like, really tremendously groundbreaking as far as what, like, would be covered in film.
Well, yeah, that's kind of the issue, is that she's very Puritan and prudish in her sexual attitudes. Her sister is very different, and her husband, of course, is different. And, yeah, the different attitudes toward sex. And then James Spader's characters, his sexual issues, it's all sort of about sex without actually being sexy or having really any sex in it.
I eventually do like McDowell's character and where it goes. It just mm-hmm. takes me a long time to warm up to her here. I wish
she were a better actress.
I know. I was thinking, like, how cool if you just took the first two-thirds of this movie and then made at the end, like, it could go really easily into thriller, into somebody
yeah.
being killed. Like there is that slight tension and nervousness in watching this film, and that's mm-hmm. really cool. Also, some like filmmaking techniques. The way, considering it's his first film, the way that he bleeds audio or leads audio into the next scene. Like, you're not seeing it, but then there's that. There's some good tracking shots as well. Like, a lot of that stuff, it feels like. Somebody who knows what they're doing.
You can tell this was someone who was very talented, who was going to break out big once he got a chance.
By the way, how uncomfortable was it when the little sister finally decides to sit down for a taped interview, and he asks about her first sexual encounter?
Yeah.
And she described something when she was 8?
Yeah.
But it wasn't even a sexual encounter. It was very confusing.
It was sort of pre-sexual. And, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very uncomfortable.
But anyway, that was just like, I was like, hang on, go back. Like, one of you needs to have follow-up questions here.
So yeah, I like this movie. Glad we saw it.
Me
Sex,
too.
Lies, and Videotape. Hooray for us.
I feel good about us.
Mm-hmm. Now, our movie for July, also from the 80s, and it's called Dangerous Liaison. Dangerous Liaisons with Glenn Close and John Malkovich and, ooh, Michelle Pfeiffer. Oh, Swoozy Kurtz.
Wait, is Daniel Day-Lewis in this?
No.
Oh. Huh.
Were you thinking of something else?
I wonder what I was thinking of.
Age of Innocence. Daniel Day-Lewis, yes. And Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yes.
Yeah.
At least I'll get to see Michelle Pfeiffer. That's the important part.
So yeah, Dangerous Liaisons from 1988. That's our movie for July. So you have all of July to watch it. You listeners and us. And then we'll talk about it the first week of August.
Oh, also, Sex, Lies, and Videotape is made for about $1.2 million, made $25 million at the box office.
Pretty good.
Yeah. For an indie, that was huge.
Yes, yeah. Uma Thurman is in Dangerous Liaisons.
Spoiler.
The DVDs this week, there aren't any. Smurfs. Smurfs, The Lost Village. And then some ones that we didn't see.
And, yeah, The Lost City of Z, which I think is coming my way. Maybe it's a little late. I will see it. We will talk about it if it's worth talking about.
Yeah. So don't watch any DVDs.
Right.
And then that brings us to the end of our program. We had a fine day today, movie-wise, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Here's what we had. Spider-Man Homecoming. BS approved.
Boom. BS approved.
The Big Sick. BS approved.
Two for two. Let's keep it going.
The Little Hours. It was good enough.
Yeah, it was.
Not quite BS approved, but, no. You know, good enough. So, yeah, there's some fine options and some a few other good things still in theaters, too. So you shouldn't be too sad this weekend if you're looking for a movie to watch. We got some good choices. Baby Driver. Oh, remember Baby Driver?
I do remember that.
It's a good movie, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's it, then. Until next week, for Movie BS with Baron Snyder, I'm Eric D. Snyder.
I am Jeff Baer.
Thanks for listening, and good day.
Said good day.